Heart-related health problems affect millions of people each year. Maybe you're one of the many who suffer from issues related to angina pain, high blood pressure, congestive heart failure, unbalanced cholesterol, irregular heartbeat, or clogged arteries. There is a solution that doesn't involve expensive prescription drugs that only mask the problem and leave you with horrible side effects. If you are ready to live your life free of sickness, pain, and fear, live your life with increased vitality, energy, and youthfulness, and experience your body healing itself, then you're ready for Heart and Body Extract from Healthy Hearts Club. Heart and Body Extract has a 23-year proven track record of using certified organic herbs that make up an excellent formula to balance and support the heart and circulatory system. In as little as 2 weeks, you can feel amazing results when your 2-month supply of Heart and Body Extract today. Call 1-866-295-5305 or go to hbextract.com.
Have you ever wanted to learn where you can get free food and medicine from the plants growing around your neighborhood? Or how to turn your own backyard into a food production center? Or even how to reverse cancers using the latest groundbreaking research in alternative cancer therapies? You can learn all this and more from webseed.com. It's sort of like Netflix, but it's for documentaries and how-to courses on natural health, food production, self-reliance, and other life-saving topics. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, and I created Webseed so that listeners like you could get instant streaming access to truly groundbreaking instructional courses. Our new program called Vaccines Armed and Dangerous exposes the total fraud of modern vaccine quackery. And our Surthrival course teaches emergency preparedness, including skills like how to build your own emergency water filter. Explore over 100 valuable courses and documentaries right now at WEBSEED.com.
Do you know someone who can benefit from this radio program? You can find the complete archives of this show and hundreds of others at naturalnewsradio.com. Just send your friend that link, naturalnewsradio.com, where they will find truly amazing interviews and information that simply isn't published anywhere else. In the Natural News Radio archives, you'll find interviews with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, Senator Rand Paul, Governor Jesse Ventura, Suzanne Summers, alternative cancer doctors, nutrition experts, preparedness experts, and a wealth of others. And it's all free. Listen in real time at naturalnewsradio.com or download the MP3 archive files anytime you want to listen on your phone, mobile devices, or personal computer. When you want articles on these topics, check out naturalnews.com with over 35,000 article pages on nutrition, natural cures, health freedom, and much more. It's all part of the Natural News Network. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, welcome to Survival and Beyond, and I'm your host, as usual, Ed Corcoran, here on Natural News Radio, as well as the Prepper Podcast Radio Network, and bringing you all of the information and the news that you need to survive and be prepared in these times, as well as, using the royal we, the editorial, my overreaching goal, my ambition is to wake people up and to liberate minds and distill things down to what I call the essence of truth and illusion, because it only comes down to two things. It's either truth or illusion. And unfortunately, everything that we live, everything that we believe, all the structures that we've built or are allowed to be built around ourselves is an illusion. But we're going to get to that a little bit later. Right now, I want to talk about last week. Those of you who were listening to the show last week, I had Mike Moore, the co-founder of the new social network called Awareness Act. And Awareness Act is dubbed as Facebook for Patriots. Or the complete tagline is Facebook for Patriots, not Potatoes. And I think that's the unofficial tagline. I don't know if they're using that officially, but I like it. I mean, you know, it's because that's what Facebook is. It's for potatoes. It's not for Patriots. And the Patriots that are on there, and there's lots of them out there. I'll tell you, boy, all of my friends, all of my Facebook friends, and all of my the followers of Survival and Beyond, the fans, I don't know, what do you call them now? They're not fans anymore, or they're whatever, you know what it is. But all of my friends are Patriots, and that's my main criteria when somebody gives me a friend request. You know, I think a lot of people, if they get a friend request, they just, you know, it strokes their ego and they immediately approve them. I don't approve anybody until I check them out a little bit and see what they're all about. And, yeah. And so I've got thousands, there's thousands of Patriots and there's thousands of people, liberty-minded people on Facebook. I know this because, you know, between the Survival and Beyond page and my personal page, you know, I have thousands of friends and followers. And I hate followers too. I don't like any of the adjectives that they use to describe. I don't like fans. I don't like followers. The folks that I know on Facebook, they're all Patriots, and so I know they're out there. And there's always that, you know, whenever you're posting on Facebook, you know, there's always that specter in the back of your head. There's always that shadow that looms over you, knowing that Facebook is a data mining apparatus. It's a surveillance tool. It's being, you know, it's not a conspiracy theory, you know. I mean, all you have to do is look at Brandon Raub, who got hauled away to a mental institution because of what he posted on Facebook. And so, you know, it's a well-known fact that this is a government surveillance device, Facebook. You know, they want to see who to put on the red list and who to put on the blue list and who's going to be spending time under government supervision, to use a incredible euphemism. So Awareness Act was founded with the ideal that it would be a private social network that was privately owned with rock solid super security, where patriots can go and discuss and talk about the issues that we're facing without the fear of being surveilled, without the fear of having their posts read and evaluated and being targeted by the Department of Homeland Surveillance and being carted away, you know. And it's really exciting. It's, you know, it's exciting to be a part of it. And I had Mike Moore on the show, and shortly after, now I'm not sure if I can fully take credit for this, but shortly after it aired on Natural News Radio, Awareness Act was inundated with a wave, just an enormous amount of people visiting the site, so much so that it crashed their server. And, you know, I was talking to Marshall Nelson, their resident tech guru, you know, genius, and this guy is phenomenal. And yeah, when he set up the site, you know, of course they weren't expecting to have to handle a whole lot of people, and so the way he configured it, and I can't explain it because I'm not that tech savvy to go into it, but you know, he configured it for, you know, a reasonable amount of traffic, nowhere near expecting the amount of traffic that came in. So if you guys went and visited Awareness Act after hearing about it on my show, then, you know, that's great. I'm glad to hear it. Glad to hear that the word is getting out, and that, you know, that I'm helping get the word out, because I think this is a great project. I think it's a great idea, a great social network and everything. It's very exciting to be a part of it. And I've actually been playing a part in helping the development and, you know, and work out some of the quirks, and not just some of the bugs, but, you know, coming up with ideas and, you know, and seeing them implemented. I mean, I would never see that on Facebook. You know, it's like you don't even know who to talk to on Facebook. There's no way of talking to anybody on Facebook who's, you know, actually running it or, you know, behind the scenes or whatever. There's no customer service. There's no chat line. There's no email that you can send to, you know. It's like I'm on Awareness Act, and, you know, and I'll just get on Skype and say, hey, Marshall, it'd be really cool if you added this thing. And boom, like a half an hour later, it's there, you know. So it's really been fun, and it's really been exciting, and it's good to be a part of it. So with that being said, if you haven't visited Awareness Act yet, I highly recommend you do. It's a home. It's a home for patriots. It's a home for dissidents. It's a home for free-thinking people. And go on there, join up. I've got a personal page on there. You can friend me, Ed Corcoran. And there's also a Survival and Beyond page where you can keep up with the things going on in the show. And I've also got a development working where people will be able to listen to the show on Awareness Act. It hasn't been implemented yet, but that's one of the ideas that we've been talking about. So, yeah, go and check it out. It's awarenessact.com and Facebook for Patriots, man. So anyway, moving on, I wanted to talk about I want to talk about a bunch of things. This is what always happens to me. Like every time I sit down and do my show, I've got like 500 things going on just spinning around my head. And, you know, and I've said this before, you know, I never get the chance to cover all of it. And even when I do cover, I feel like I didn't get to cover it as thoroughly as I'd like, as I would have liked to. And what I started doing is what I started realizing, like, I was having too many guests on the show. I get so many great guests that want to be on the show that I can't say no to them. And so, you know, if I do, I end up doing a couple of interviews a week, and I just have a hard time saying, well, I'm going to save this person for next week, or I'm going to, you know, I want to have as much as I possibly can. But what that was doing was that was limiting my, voice, really. That was limiting the time that I had to cover the issues that, that I wanted to. And as I said at the beginning of the show, apart from the survival and preparedness information, which is very important, you know, but apart from that, I think it's also important to get the truth out there and to speak about the issues that, you may not hear on other, you're certainly not going to hear it on the mainstream media. That's for sure. And that's another issue that I'm going to get into in a bit, but, you really don't hear a lot of it in the survival, community. And that's not a criticism, you know, like I know that everybody who's a prepper is a patriot. I know that everybody who's into survivalism, they're hip to what's going on. They know the score, and but not all of them are choosing to speak about it because of, you know, one reason or another. And I think most of it is to, you know, like I haven't taken a survey or anything, but I think a lot of people are concerned about, you know, OPSEC. They're concerned about, making themselves a target, to the powers that be, which is completely valid, you know, and I respect that. However, you know, and this is my belief, and this is my philosophy, and my philosophy alone, and I don't criticize anybody for not sharing that philosophy. But my belief is that if they're going to get you, they're going to get you, and there's really no way that you can, you know, you're not going to hide. My ultimate goal is to get the truth out there, and that's the truth on any number of levels. So that's what it's all about. That's what it's all about for me. And I feel like I needed to, you know, allow more time for that. And, you know, what I was doing before, I have two guests on and, you know, and that, and I wasn't having time to really, really talk about the truth and to, you know, liberate people from, and I might be kidding myself that I'm waking anybody up or I'm liberating any minds, you know, but I have to try. I have to do it because, Silence is the ally of evil. Just like the old saying goes, the only thing that needs to, the only thing that's required for tyranny to succeed, or to for tyranny to for evil to prevail, is for good men to do nothing. So that's what it is in a nutshell. And hopefully you're going to dig it. Hopefully you'll learn something. Hopefully you'll be, dare I say, enlightened. I don't know about that, but at least you'll always know you're hearing the truth, and you'll, or at least the truth as I understand it. And it's always open for discussion, and it's always open for debate. Speaking of debates, wow, that worked into a smooth segue. That almost never happens. I just want to say a few words about the recent presidential debate. And, you know, I wasn't going to watch it, and I didn't watch it when it was on live. Well, I couldn't watch it. I don't have television, because television is the tool of the New World Order. It is the instrument that keeps you compliant. It keeps you conditioned. It keeps you brainwashed. And yeah, I know that sounds extreme. And I say that to people, and people look at me like I'm, well, like I'm a kook, honestly. And I'm talking like people in the real world. There's a new neighbor who moved in up here on this crazy mountain, and he was talking about getting satellite, and he's like, oh, geez, what do you get for TV out here? I told him, frankly, I don't know. I don't have television. I shouldn't say I never had it, but, you know, I haven't had it for a long time. And he was saying, I'm thinking about maybe, you know, he's going through the whole thing, you know. And this is another thing, too. Like, this is an observation, all right? This is a little bit of an observational thing that I've noticed since I don't have, since I've not had television for a while. And I've mentioned this before. You know, you step away from it, you get out of its influence, and you start to notice things that other people don't notice. And this is my observation. I mean, this really speaks to how completely saturated we are with entertainment. And that is by design. That is, our culture has been developed that way intentionally, deliberately, where your choices of the delivery system in which you are going to have the entertainment brought to you is such a major deal. You know, should I get cable? Should I get Dish Network? Should I get DirecTV? Should I get, you know, and I'm like, man, just don't get anything. I told him this. I literally said, you know, television is just brainwashing, you know, so, and you're paying to be brainwashed, and you're trying to figure out which is the best deal to have your brainwashing delivered to you. Should it be by satellite? Should it be by cable? Who's got the best rates? Who's going to change them after 6 months? Are you going to get locked into a contract? Blah, blah, blah. Oh, my God. You know, you would think that you were choosing, you know, the school that you're going to send your child to or something. You know, the way people fret and fetish over television, you know. And then, you know, you mentioned that the brainwashing thing, and those who don't think that you're a total kook, those who want to seem hip, the people who want to seem like they're, you know, they're aware and they're happening, they know what you're talking about, then they start with the rationalizations. They start with, well, you know, I don't watch that much television, actually, blah blah blah, and everything. You know, it's kind of like when I tell people that I don't drink, you know. And if you're at a social event or something like that, and you know somebody where people are drinking and somebody's talking to you, whatever, and you mention that you don't drink, or they happen to notice that you don't drink, and that's always like, you know, something that sticks out, you know, to people, like, oh, how come this guy's not drinking? How come he doesn't have a beer? What's wrong with this guy? You know, and as soon as you tell people that you don't drink, my observation is, anyway, when I tell people I don't drink, then they start making excuses for their own drinking, and they start saying things like, well, yeah, I don't really drink that much myself, and, you know, just occasionally a couple here on the weekends, blah, holidays, blah, 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 whatever, you know. And I usually, my response is, I don't care. What are you explaining this to me for? Why are you rationalizing this to me? You know, it doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter to me. And it's the same thing with the television. When I told this guy, I was like, television is just brainwashed. Well, you know, I don't really watch that much television. I just get it for the news and blah, blah, blah. And that's when I said, you think you're getting the news? No. You think what you're receiving is no. And this is where it turns. That's when they start like looking at me like I'm crazy, and I get a tinfoil hat on my head. And so, and speaking of segues, this leads me up to the next story about the news. Hey, folks, if the recent developments regarding CNN getting caught fabricating the news isn't enough to make you want to throw your television out the window, then I don't know what is. If that's not going to wake somebody up, I don't know how to wake them up. I don't do like a bomb, a hand grenade, whatever is not going to do it. You know, you are not getting the news. And on a intellectual level, yeah, I know most of you know this already, and preaching to the choir and all that good stuff. But for those of you who still think that you're getting a little bit of the truth on television, it ain't happening anymore, you know? And I'm not putting myself on a pedestal. I'm not looking down on people who watch television. I'm not looking down on people who watch the mainstream news, whatever. I'm not saying I'm better than anybody or anything like that, because I was there. I was there at one time until I got woken up, until I realized that, hey, this is all BS. This is all, this is not true. I used to believe, actually, and it wasn't too long ago. It wasn't too long ago where I believe that, some of the stuff on the news is true. And, well, yeah, that is true. I mean, if there's a hurricane somewhere and they're reporting on the hurricane, then, yeah, I'm not saying that they're lying about the hurricane or the earthquake or, whatever. But it's tailored. What is true that's being reported is tailored and spun and sanitized and orchestrated for your and manipulated for your consumption. But CNN, man, they ought to call that the creative news network at this point. You know, Amber Lyon, whom I mentioned on the show last week, the former CNN correspondent turned whistleblower. You know, she's been all over the alternative media out there about the whitewashing, the censorship and all that about her reporting from Bahrain. And it turns out that CNN was being paid by the regime to portray to downplay the turmoil that was going on and to only show positive images of Bahrain, show people having fun, show people at the racetrack, showing people doing, like it's a tourist, it's a tourist destination. And Amber Lyon did this documentary this journalism that was completely just ignored. It was not aired on CNN International, and it turns out that CNN was actually accepting money, and CNN gets paid by the government, by the U.S. government, to tailor the news. And they completely made up all of that reporting from Danny, Syria Danny, all of these reports where he's, Anderson Cooper is asking him questions about what's going on. It's like, oh, it's terrible, it's bombing, and 200 people died in the last half hour, and blah, 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 and everything like that. And it was totally, just completely fabricated. There's a video that was the unedited video that was leaked where, they show them discussing, what to say and where to put the sound effects and everything like that. I mean, why this didn't end Anderson Cooper's career is beyond me. Why this hasn't completely, you know, caused a controversy with the network itself, with CNN itself, is beyond me. I mean, I knew that CNN was making up the news years ago, you know, like the whole thing, at least as far back, this is what is documented. This is, you know, at least what, you know, there's probably scores of other examples of them just completely making up the news. But way back in the first Gulf War, you know, there, tapes were leaked by CNN employees of Charles Jocko doing this hard-hitting, on-the-spot journalistic reporting from Saudi Arabia in the first Gulf War that was done on a soundstage with a blue screen behind him, and it was all fake, you know? CNN, fake news. All the rest of them, for all I'm, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it's all fake too. Believe none of it. Don't. I mean, how can you? You know, if you can go back and back to CNN and still think that you're getting the truth and you're still getting the uncensored, you know, reality. You know, which reality is this very subjective thing, which we're going to talk about after the break. But if you think you're getting that, yeah, forget about it. But, yeah, now that I've gone off on that tangent, I was talking about the debate, and I got sidetracked into the whole thing about me not watching television. The debate, I didn't watch it, I wasn't going to watch it, and then I thought, well, I owe it to myself to actually watch this thing. If I'm going to be a political commentator or a critic or pundit of any kind, and you know, I have to watch this stuff. I don't want to, but I would be speaking out of ignorance, and you know, considering that I'm broadcasting, albeit on the internet, you know, I need to know this stuff. I need to watch this. And so I dutifully went to YouTube, which YouTube is great, another instrument for freedom and for truth and information. You know, it's been said by other people. I don't take credit for it, but, you know, people learn more stuff on YouTube than they ever will from television. And so I went on YouTube and I looked up the presidential debate. And part of the reason why I wanted to watch it was because, you know, I was hearing all this stuff out in the on the internet about how Barack Obama had his ass handed to him by Mitt Romney. And so I'm like, well, you know, I'm no fan of Mitt Romney either. I mean, oh God, this election, man. Well, I guess they're all pretty much the same, you know. It's like, but this one in particular, it's like we're being asked to choose between Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler. You know, it's indescribable. The overwhelming feeling of futility that this election just makes me feel in the pit of my stomach, in the depth of my soul. But I did want to see Barry's ass handed to him. So I went online and I watched it, and you know, I didn't get that. I really didn't see what all the Romney supporters were, you know, celebrating and patting each other on the back about, because it didn't seem to me like a, you know, a verbal trouncing so much as it seemed like a couple of puppets dancing around in circles and avoiding talking about the real issues, and by all means not talking about the 900-pound gorilla that's in the room. And by real issues, I mean, think of it this way. They're out there spinning around in circles like a couple of dogs chasing their own damn tail, and going on and on about Obamacare and about this and that. And, you know, if you think Romney's going to repeal Obamacare, then I've got some shorefront property in Arizona to sell you. He's the engineer of Obama. He's the architect of Obamacare. I used to live in Massachusetts, unfortunately, and that's what it's all about. And if you listen to, this is the thing that people miss when they hear Romney talking about repealing Obamacare. That's not the end of the sentence. The full sentence is, I will repeal Obamacare and replace it with something else, or I will replace Obamacare. Nobody ever hears that, you know. What they hear is, oh, he's going to repeal Obamacare, and that's it. You know, selective hearing, and we all in this country have a very terrible case of selective hearing, when, you know, a horrible case of selective hearing and selective seeing and selective acknowledging and so on and so on. But these two puppets are dancing around the subject. And, you know, if I were Mitt Romney, this is the thing that struck me. If I were Mitt Romney, right, if I really wanted to tear into Barry, if I wanted to just really hand him his ass, you know, I would go on, I would assault him on the NDAA. I would assault him on Section 1021 about American indefinite detention for Americans, about the suspension of due process, about the fact that, you know, he promises that he's never going to use these powers that he was forced to sign the NDAA. It was the Republicans. The Republicans forced me to sign it. If I didn't sign it, then I wouldn't be support. You know, it would look like I don't support our troops and everything. And that's another thing. You know, this whole expression, this whole Pavlovian response that's been engendered in our collective psyches about that expression, support our troops. I support our troops. Put something out there, put out something that nobody in their right mind would want to object to, or, you know, nobody would want to question or whatever, right? What, you ever ask yourself what that means? When you say, I support our troops, I've done it myself. I say it all the time, or I used to say it all the time. You know, it's like, oh, don't get me wrong, I support our troops and blah, 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 but I don't support the wars. And everybody has to make that qualifier, you know, like as if they didn't, make that qualifier, like I support our troops, and, you know, it's just been ingrained in us that, this is the way you ought to feel. And if you don't feel that way, then there's something wrong with you. Well, the I support our troops thing is just another mechanism. This is another trigger. This is another, I called it Pavlovian, but it's actually more like neuro-linguistic programming. It's what they call an anchor in NLP. And this is something that, you know, you hear it enough times and you think you know what it means, or, you know, you don't put a whole lot of critical thought into it. So, you know, the whole thing about supporting our troops, supporting them, the government doesn't even support them. You know, like they have to buy their own gear. They have to buy their own stuff. But I'm not going to go off on a tangent about that. But Barry's whole excuse about the NDAA was like, oh, it was the Republicans who made me do it. And I didn't want to do it because you didn't want to do it because of Section 1021. And you're going to give yourself dictatorial powers and extrajudicial authority. You know, baloney. I call bull on that, okay? Because you're the one who insisted that that section be, when it was removed, you're the one who insisted that it be put back in. When Catherine Forrest issued the permanent injunction on NDAA on the grounds of Section 1021, the first thing you did was you turned around and you went to a higher court, or you went to the Court of Appeals within 24 hours to have a stay put on that ruling. And on September 28th, a panel of three judges, all appointed by you, Barry, decided that, well, we're gonna extend the stay on NDAA. You know, so don't give me this baloney like you were resistant to sign the NDAA and you were doing it just, you know, to because you were concerned about, you know, appearing as though you don't support the troops. That is what I would attack Obama on. Now, do you know why Romney didn't do that? Do you know why Romney didn't go off about the 30,000 drones flying over the U.S. Airspace, the surveillance drones, which, oh, by the way, if you don't think they're going to be armed and used as weapons against us, then, you know, I suggested, you know, you open up a big can of wake up. You know why Romney didn't confront him on any of these issues? Because Romney is going to carry through with them. He's going to pick up those balls. He's going to pick up that ball and he's going to run with it. You think he's going to change anything about the NDAA? Of course not. He would be foolish if he did. Hey, he's going to inherit, if he gets elected, he's going to inherit all the dictatorial powers that Obama set up. All of them. So if you think this is really the crux of the biscuit, I mean, all these arguments about, you know, whether there's any difference between Romney and Obama, of course they're not. But this is really where it comes. This is where the rubber hits the road, folks, and proving that point, okay? Romney is going to carry on with all of the dictatorial executive order baloney bull crap. God, you know I don't. You know I'd rather say something else here, but it's a family network. yeah, it's going to be just, you know, he's going to pick up the ball and continue on with it, and that is the real serious issue about the lack of difference between Romney and Obama, and that is why you're not going to get anything different from. Forget about health care. Forget about taxes. Forget about all that other crap. Okay, forget about it. It's irrelevant. That's business as usual for politicians and for elections and for campaigns. All this taxation, it's all a distraction. It's a distraction, so you're not paying attention to the 900-pound gorilla in the room, and that 900-pound gorilla is called tyranny. And tyranny is going to run roughshod over all of us if we don't put an end to it. Now, how do we put an end to that? We put an end to that by first speaking out about it, first and foremost, by sharing this information with as many people as possible, and by doing everything that you possibly can to, and you know what, I'd like to say I have the answer to this because, you know, I've gotten kind of despondent about this whole election situation, and, you know, I'm really kind of, well, not kind of. I'm very let down about Ron Paul no longer being in the running, and it's not Dr. Paul's fault. You know, he just got railroaded. I've been looking at Gary Johnson. You know, those of you who are thinking that you're going to write in Ron Paul, that was my original thought. You know, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to write it. You know, cast a write-in vote. But I've been looking at Gary Johnson, and that's looking more and more like my candidate. And if you think that he can't win, if you think that casting a vote for Gary Johnson or casting a vote for Ron Paul, for that matter, is a vote for Obama, well, then you don't understand the way it's supposed to work anyway, and not the way it does. But if you're going to cast a vote for, you know, Joseph Stalin, just so that Adolf Hitler doesn't stay in office, doesn't stay in power, then guess what you're going to get, folks. But we're going to take a quick break right now, and we'll be back. Just hang tight, and we'll see you on the other side of this commercial break by our great sponsors who keep the show going.
Silver has been in use as an effective antimicrobial for thousands of years, and this old technology is still in use today. In 2001, a patent was approved for a new medical silver application, nanocatalytic silver hydrosols. Unlike conventional colloidal silver products, some of the advantages of nanosilver include up to 300% greater bioavailability, proven non-toxicity in over 25 university and FDA-approved laboratory studies, and extreme stability with a shelf life of over 10 years. Guarantee. With just one product, you can replace all the antibiotics, wound and burn dressings, and water purification products in your medical bug out bag. These products have been patented for use against some of the deadliest pathogens known, many that are resistant to traditional antibiotics, yet are safe and gentle enough for treating a baby's diaper rash. To learn more about this medical silver breakthrough and see the published scientific studies, visit www.lifesilver.com. All orders ship within 24 hours with deep discounts and free shipping for case orders. That's www.lifesilver.com. Survival is not about the end of the world. It's not about a hypothetical plane crash or the latest violent storm. Survival is about the satisfaction of knowing you can take care of yourself and your family in any situation, anytime, anywhere. CampingSurvival.com was started in 1956. No, not the .com part, the survival part. CampingSurvival.com has over 17,000 urban, wilderness, and preparedness items. Supreme customer service, very low shipping, and no games. We look around to make sure we have the lowest prices. And CampingSurvival.com is 100% USMC veteran-owned. Don't base your survival on the latest spring up on the internet company. Do business with an authority on survival. CampingSurvival.com. Confidence born on preparation.
Okay, we're back at Survival and Beyond. And remember, you can get 5% off all of your purchases at campingsurvival.com by entering the coupon code SBRadio. That's S as in survival, B as in beyond, and the word radio. And it's all one word. Enter the coupon code, get 5% off at campingsurvival.com. Go get yours now before it's too late, for crying out sakes. So I want to get back to something that I mentioned earlier in the show, at the beginning of the show, the essence of truth and illusion. And you might be asking yourself, Ed, what do you mean by that? What does the essence of truth and illusion mean? Well, this is something that's very important. It's probably just as important as the physical, material, survival information, or, you know, having food storage and water and shelter and all that. It's probably, it may be even more important. And it's something that's a little bit hard for me to describe, to explain. You know, I'll be talking more and more about it in subsequent shows, but this is something I've kind of danced around this subject, because I didn't really know how to approach it, or, you know, like kind of what angle to come at it, you know, and get it out there. But the search, the quest, the seeking of truth is paramount to your survival. And being able to discern truth from illusion. And what do I mean by illusion? Well, I mean, what is portrayed on television and what we're brainwashed into thinking, that's part of it. That's definitely part of it, but it's not that's not the totality of it. That's not all of it. What illusion is basically what the human species has been living in for centuries, what we've been bamboozled into believing what life is, what we are as beings, as living sentient creatures, because of the way that our brains are wired, because of the way our brains work. Somebody figured out a long time ago how to trick us into seeing things that aren't really there, and how to trick us into not seeing things that are there. What I mean by that is that it's a construct. And people have made analogies to, you know, like the movie The Matrix. You know, like I hate to evoke that kind of comparison, but it is fairly accurate. It is fairly accurate. I mean, you know, going back in human history, we've known a lot more in the past than we do right now. And the control mechanism that's been used against us is to present us with a falsehood, to present us with an erroneous belief, you know, and it manifests itself in this modern time. And I'm choosing my words very carefully, because it's a hard subject to approach. It's a hard subject to explain, and I don't understand it completely myself. I'll be completely honest with you. I am a truth seeker. I am not a truth dispenser, as it were. I believe that if you meet somebody who says they're seeking the truth, then stick by them. Stick with those people. If you meet somebody who tells you they know the truth and they're going to give it to you, I would walk away from them. I would avoid them, because nobody can know exactly, you know, the whole truth and say, well, I'm going to enlighten you. From almost the beginning of human civilization, once we became civilized, there was almost immediately a body of persons who wanted to control us, wanted to suppress what we are, suppress the knowledge of what we are. The thinking that keeps us limited, that is the shell that we've been kept in right? We are not limited creatures. We are not limited beings. It is only our thinking that makes us believe that. And I touched on this a little bit last week, you know, about manifesting your reality, and it goes beyond mere positive thinking. And all of you just think good thoughts and good things will happen. Well, that's kind of the truth. The only problem with positive thinking is that, and this dovetails perfectly with the whole prepper philosophy of, you know, pray for the best, but prepare for the worst, is that positive thinking is kind of like a Band-Aid, or it's something that, you know, it sounds like it makes sense. And so what we do is, like, we just plaster this layer of positive thinking over this enormous mass of negative thinking, and that accomplishes nothing. That's only lip service. You're only fooling yourself. You're only duping yourself into believing that, you know, that it's going to work. And it might work on a limited level, but it's not about positive thinking. I mean, it is about positive thinking. You do need to have a positive thinking, but you need to have a paradigm shift in your thinking. It's more than just, you know, think happy thoughts and read The Secret and watch Oprah every day, and, you know, and all these wonderful things are going to happen. It's not as simple as that. Nothing ever is. But if you're just pasting a happy face on top of your cynicism and your negativity, well, that stuff is going to eventually come to the surface, and your method of positive thinking is paper thin, and it's not going to accomplish anything. What you need to do is you need to realize that almost everything that you know is wrong. And that's a hard pill to swallow. It certainly was for me, but, you know, and I'm not talking about anything that is, what I'm talking about is provable. It's fact. I mean, you know, I'm talking about things that have been proven by science, by quantum mechanics. You know, I've said before on this show, if you've listened to my show regularly, you've heard me say it on a number of occasions, that everything is connected. We are all connected. Everything is energy. Everything is vibration, frequency. Matter is only energy vibrating at a slower rate. There was a time when, you know, after the microscope was invented and we discovered that our bodies are made up of individual cells, and there was a time when the thought was that that was the smallest particle in the universe, that everything was made of cells, and that's as far as it went, until we discovered the atom. Then we thought, aha, okay, this is the smallest particle. This is what everything breaks down to. These are the building blocks. And then we realized that even the atom breaks down even smaller into particles. And it's like, okay, so there's the atom with the nucleus, and it's and electrons are orbiting, and so these are the smallest particles. Well, then we find out that the nucleus is made up of smaller particles. And you see where I'm getting at right here. It just keeps on going further and further down the rabbit hole. And then we discovered that the nucleus of the atom is not even solid. It's mostly empty space. Yet it contains the most enormous amount of power that there is. So scale and size is meaningless. You know, and you can probably go down further and further. And furthermore, we realized that nothing is real. nothing is, at least not in the way that we observe it, is real. Everything that exists is in a state of flux. It's a state of a potential, a wave of potentiality, which means that it isn't really anything until you observe it. So an atom is actually everywhere. That observation actually has an influence on the behavior of subatomic particles. So it's doing whatever it wants. It doesn't really, it exists, but it doesn't exist at the same time. But when you look at it, well, then it has to make a decision, and almost as if there was a thought process going on. It's a wave until you look at it, then it becomes a particle, and it has a particular space or position in space, in space-time. But when you're not looking, well, it's It's just potential. That can be applied to just about everything that we think of as reality. And it's the same thing with thought. Thought is real. Thought is an actual it's an actual thing. You know, for lack of a better way of describing it, to another scientific experiment that was done by a Japanese scientist with water. When you project different thoughts into water and you freeze it, it forms different patterns. When you project positive thoughts into it, it crystallizes in one particular formation. You project negative thoughts into it, then it crystallizes into a very disrupted, very unnatural-looking formation. If you can influence the way the molecules in water arrange itself by your thoughts, imagine what effect that's having on your life. If you get angry on a regular, on a daily basis, if you get frustrated on a daily basis, if you get impatient on a daily basis, think of what that's doing to you. Think of what that's doing to anybody in your general vicinity. You are projecting energy. That's been proven by Curlian photography. We can't see it. We don't have the we don't have the senses to see this, and again, we're, you know, getting back into illusion and reality and the truth, and we do not have the senses to see everything, and so it's and we sometimes don't have the senses to not see everything. We have the ability to not see things that are actually there that should be visible. For example, when Columbus first showed up in the Americas, the native people could not see the ships, because this is the way, speaking of the way our brains are wired, the way we see things, we can't even rely on the things that we see as being real. And getting back to the story about Columbus, when Columbus originally showed up in the Americas, the native people who lived here already, they couldn't see his ships, because the way our brain works is a lot of it functions on pattern matching and pattern recognition. And they could not see the ships because they had never even imagined anything like the huge sailing vessels that were on the ocean approaching their shoreline. It didn't compute. It didn't compute in their heads, and so therefore they didn't see it. And this speaks to, again, you know, to what we consider reality. There are things all around us that we cannot see because either A, it was basically, you know, or figuratively beaten out of us, you know, when as children, you know, we're taught that, you know, these things don't exist. I mean, children are very perceptive. The children can see things that adults can't, because nobody's taught them that they don't exist yet. Or nobody's convinced them, I should say, that they don't exist. And also we're taught that, you know, the things that we see aren't real, and we're making this up, and your imaginary friend, you know, and everything. You know, I truly believe that, you know, children who have imaginary friends, they actually have imaginary friends, and they're no less real than, you know, your flesh and blood, actual physical material world entities. But The brain is such a complex organ, and I think it was fascinating when I first heard the story about the natives. They couldn't see the ships because it just didn't compute. And what the brain does with information that it can't understand, it disregards it. It just files it away somewhere, and, you know, just doesn't. It's your brain is aware of it, but not on a conscious level, you know, and your brain, also your brain cannot tell the difference between what's real, what it sees in, you know, reality, and what it imagines. To your brain, it's all the same thing. That's why you get, you know, did you ever wonder why you get frightened by your own nightmares? You know, I always used to think, well, like, doesn't my brain know that it's the nightmare is a product of itself, that my brain is making this stuff up? Why would I be scared of Why would my brain be scared of its own thoughts? Well, it's because your brain can't differentiate. Your brain can't tell the difference between what it imagines and what it actually experiences in the real world. They discovered this when they started doing experiments with PET scans and CAT scans. They would show a person an object and observe the brain functions, what parts of the brain were firing when they were looking at an object, and then they would ask them to imagine that object, and the same parts of the brain were being activated just by visualizing it. You know how they say that if you can imagine it, you can create it? Well, it also works in reverse. If you can't imagine it, then you won't even be aware of it. You know, again with the ships. And what happened with the natives, when they couldn't see the ships, the shaman of the tribe could see that there's a disturbance in the water, and he still couldn't see the ships, but he could see that something was there. And because of the shamanistic practices, the shamanic brain, if that's even a word, is wired a little bit differently. And eventually he could see the ships. And when he saw the ships, he told the rest of the tribe that there are these great big vessels out there. I don't know what word they used to describe it. And because they trusted him, one by one, all of the rest of the tribe were able to see the ships. You know, and I think when I heard that story, it also ties into the fact that, you know, when you hear ancient stories of what some people presume to be UFOs, extraterrestrials, or extraterrestrial vessels, you know, oftentimes they're described as a dragon or a great bird, or, you know, and that's partly because they just didn't have the vocabulary to say, oh, well, that's a flying saucer, or that's a spaceship, or that's a, you know, they'd never seen a flying vessel before in their lives. And also because of the fact that their brains probably just interpreted it into whatever it could, whatever model or whatever pattern that it could recognize. So what they saw, instead of seeing a gleaming metal ship, they saw a dragon, or they saw, you know, a giant bird or a flying carpet, or, you know, all these other analogies that are used. I guess what I'm doing is I'm laying the groundwork in describing, you know, how the brain works and visually, and trying to describe a process that's very complicated. But this is how we're tricked. This is how the illusion is presented, or is part of how the illusion is presented to us, and how we get stuck in a life where that's all about, and has been for centuries, and especially in the last 100 years or so, we got stuck into believing that that this model of life is normal, that it is normal for us to be slaves. And make no mistake about it, we are slaves. Or let me qualify that. Hells no, we're not slaves. But we have been made into slaves by playing upon, by this. I mean, this is ancient knowledge. This is ancient knowledge on how to deceive us, how to use illusion against us, make us believe the illusion. And this has been in operation long since before there was television, and long since before there was Hollywood. And it was done with imagery, with symbols, with suppression of literacy. And we've been forced to accept this condition to actually love our slavery by playing upon the way that we perceive the world around us, and the knowledge that what we perceive around us, a lot of it isn't even real anyway. You know, it's all in our heads. And if we have that power, right? And this is where it becomes empowering. This is a power that we have, and this is what I want to flip the switch in everybody's mind, so that you can understand that if those who are evil in the world can use this against us, we can turn it around and use it for, we can use it in our favor. You can manifest your reality. That is something, talk about having something beaten out of us from childhood, as a species, you know, we've had that beaten out of us. We've had our connectedness beaten out of us. We've been presented with science. We've been presented with sciences, and it's a double-edged sword, folks. Science and spirituality are not mutually exclusive, and science is just as flawed. Science is merely the act of observation. It's an observational endeavor, and science is only valid until we're able to observe something that disproves what was previously observed. So it's all observationally based, and sometimes what we're observing, you know, we're observing something that we can't even see, or we can't even process, we can't understand it. Science is not a concrete altar that's set and immutable and unchangeable. I mean, our understanding of science has definitely, I mean, anybody will concede that our understanding of science has changed considerably over the years, over the centuries. You know, even Einstein rejected quantum mechanics because he couldn't make sense of it, and the crux of that was the realization, and this has been proven, that everything is connected. All atoms are connected to each other because the experiments that were conducted at the time, they discovered that if you affect one atom, it will have an equal effect on a seemingly disparate atom, regardless of how far away it is, regardless of how far apart they are. This is referred to as spooky action at a distance. This was Einstein's words for it. And Einstein, being the genius that he was, and we have definitely, you know, we definitely owe a lot to Einstein, and he's definitely made a lot of important discoveries, but he didn't know everything. And Einstein believed this is a leftover from, you know, Newtonian physics, that the universe functions like a clock, and everything is measurable, and everything is predictable, and everything happens, and it's very machine-like, and it's very ordered, and, you know, and quantum physics says, no, it's not like that. The universe doesn't work like that at all. You know, it was too much for Einstein to handle. That's where the expression, you know, God does not play dice. You know, something either is or it isn't. It's either a wave or it's a particle. And that's the fundamental leap that Einstein just could not make. Boy, I've been going on about this, and I still haven't even gotten close to what I'm trying to say. But this won't be the last time I talk about this stuff. And if you're digging it, then, you know, I'm really happy. I hope you are. I hope you are digging it, because this is really, this could fill a whole show, what I'm talking about. And I'll get back to more of this. But what I want you to take away from this right now is that the world is not what you think it is. If we are truly going to be free, if we're truly going to realize our full potential, if we're truly going to escape from fear, And that's the big thing. I talked about this last week. You know, there's only two emotional states, really. There's fear and love. There's only two. Those are the only two powers. If we're actually going to do that, then we have to start learning that the universe and the world around us is not what we think it is. And we cannot allow others to dictate what reality is and to manipulate it, and in order to make us do what they want us to do, because it's been going on for too long. We have to reclaim our birthright. We have to reclaim the knowledge of who and what we really are and what our power really is. Because if you realize what your power is, then there's nobody that can stop you. Nobody can ever take that away from you. And really, it's never been taken away from you in the first place. You've always had it. We've always had power beyond our imagining. We just forgot it. It was suppressed. We let other people tell us. that we're small and that we're ineffectual and that we should accept our station in the universe and accept our lot in life. I was in that model. I was in that, I was in that paradigm. I was in that rut, that vicious circle, you know, of, get up, go to work, come home, do what you need to do, go to bed, get up, go to work, come home. It's, and getting nowhere, you know, and it would be, it's a tragedy. It would be a tragedy to live your entire life having never really lived. And that's what our life is. It's not a life. You know, what's typically, the life of most people, that's not living. That's not what we're supposed to be. That's not what we're supposed to do. You know, we are supposed to be creative, powerful beings that can do anything, you know, in order to get unstuck and in order to break the chains, you first have to realize that the power is within you. So having said that, we're going to take another break, and when we come back, I was going to have as a guest, I was going to have Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy on the show. They're good friends of mine, and we had a little bit of, boy, this was like an interview that didn't want to get recorded, but due to a technical glitch on my, I have a new computer that I've been using for recording my interviews, and something happened and the recording was lost. And so instead, what I'm going to do is I'm going to play an encore presentation of my interview with James Wesley Rawls. And this was, it was only aired once before, and you probably haven't heard it. If you have heard it, then I apologize. It was a good interview, and I think it's worth another listen. So we're gonna, have this interview I did with him. It was just about this time last year that I did the interview with James and, with Jim. And it was a lot of fun. And John Melandrid is on there as well. He pipes up and asks a couple questions. The former manager and operator of the Prepper Podcast Radio Network, our sister network. And so just hang tight. We're going to take a commercial break. And when we come back, we'll hear our chat with James Wesley Rawls. So I'll be back in a bit.
Do you know someone who can benefit from this radio program? You can find the complete archives of this show and hundreds of others at naturalnewsradio.com. Just send your friend that link, naturalnewsradio.com, where they will find truly amazing interviews and information that simply isn't published anywhere else. In the Natural News Radio archives, you'll find interviews with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, Senator Rand Paul, Governor Jesse Ventura, Suzanne Summers, alternative cancer doctors, nutrition experts, preparedness experts, and a wealth of others. And it's all free. Listen in real time at naturalnewsradio.com or download the MP3 archive files anytime you want to listen on your phone, mobile devices, or personal computer. When you want articles on these topics, check out naturalnews.com with over 35,000 article pages on nutrition, natural cures, health freedom, and much more. It's all part of the Natural News Network. Thanks for listening.
Heart-related health problems affect millions of people each year. Maybe you're one of the many who suffer from issues related to angina pain, high blood pressure, congestive heart failure, unbalanced cholesterol, irregular heartbeat, or clogged arteries. There is a solution that doesn't involve expensive prescription drugs that only mask the problem and leave you with horrible side effects. If you are ready to live your life free of sickness, pain, and fear, live your life with increased vitality, energy, and youthfulness, and experience your body healing itself, then you're ready for Heart and Body Extract from Healthy Hearts Club. Heart and Body Extract has a 23-year proven track record of using certified organic herbs that make up an excellent formula to balance and support the heart and circulatory system. In as little as 2 weeks, you can feel amazing results when your 2-month supply of Heart and Body Extract today. Call 1-866-295-5305 or go to hbextract.com.
Have you ever wanted to learn where you can get free food and medicine from the plants growing around your neighborhood? Or how to turn your own backyard into a food production center? Or even how to reverse cancers using the latest groundbreaking research in alternative cancer therapies? You can learn all this and more from webseed.com. It's sort of like Netflix, but it's for documentaries and how-to courses on natural health, food production, self-reliance, and other life-saving topics. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, and I created WebSeed so that listeners like you could get instant streaming access to truly groundbreaking instructional courses. Our new program called Vaccines Armed and Dangerous exposes the total fraud of modern vaccine quackery. And our Surthrival course teaches emergency preparedness, including skills like how to build your own emergency water filter. Explore over 100 valuable courses and documentaries right now at WEBSEED.com.
Okay, and my guest tonight requires no introduction from most of our listeners, if not all of them. He's one of the leading survival experts out there. He's the author of Patriots, a novel of survival in the coming collapse, and as well as How to Survive the End of the World as We Know It. And he's also the founder and editor of one of the biggest and most popular survival websites on the internet, survivalblog.com. And it's my great honor and privilege to have him on the show. So without any further delay, let me introduce Mr. James Wesley Rawls. How you doing, James?
Just fine. Thanks for having me on.
Do you prefer to be called Jim or James?
Oh, Jim is fine.
Okay, great. Yeah, so you've got a sequel. Your sequel to Patriots is coming out pretty soon, I understand. You want to tell our listeners a little bit about it?
Yeah, it's kind of unusual as sequels go. It's a novel called Survivors, and it'll be coming out October 4th, which is next Tuesday. And it will be the unique thing about this novel is that unlike most novel sequels, it doesn't go out farther into the future. It's actually contemporaneous with the action in the first novel. What it differs in is it follows a different group of characters under different circumstances. And one of the things that people encouraged me to do with my next novel was to focus on characters that were not quite as well prepared as the novel, as the protagonists of my first novel, Patriots. So in Survivors, I'm showing people that aren't well prepared, that don't have a deep larder, and that are forced to improvise for just about everything. So hopefully through that, it'll be an opportunity for people to learn a lot of different tactics and techniques and technologies for survival.
Yeah, your the first novel, Patriots, is frequently referred to as a survival guide disguised as fiction. And I couldn't agree more. I mean, you get into great detail, and there's a lot to be learned just by reading this fictitious. And it's also been called very prescient in your prediction of economic collapse and hyperinflation. And I remember reading an interview with you that was conducted, I think, in 1995, in which you listed a number of events to watch out for, and some of those things have actually happened. How close do you think that we are to a tipping point with the economy and with the dollar?
I think we're very close to a tipping point. It'll be interesting to see how things play out in Europe with the bailout of the European periphery, most importantly, Greece and Italy. There is definitely the possibility that we could see a credit crunch that is bad, if not worse, than the 2008 crunch. And it very well could spell the doom of the United States dollar and plunge us into a depression that might last multiple decades.
Two of the things that kind of woke me up when I first started getting concerned about our society as a whole, and as far as collapse goes, is economic collapse and grid crash. And in my mind, they're kind of part and parcel with each other. I mean, you know, one could cause, you know, could trigger the other, and vice versa. Do you see any kind of events like we've been seeing in the Middle East, where people are just, you know, taken to the streets and rioting, or what is the severity level that you think we're looking at, if when this does happen? I think it's a matter of when and not if.
Well, you're absolutely right when you talked about the power grid. That really is the linchpin of modern technological societies. If the grid stays up, we might see a economic depression similar to the 1930s, although with probably more crime and, you know, greater civil unrest, more rioting, protests, and so on. But if the grid goes down, all bets are off. Without the grid, we will lose our modern technological infrastructure. We'll lose all the automated inventory systems. We'll lose communications. We'll lose water systems in probably 80% or 90% of American cities don't have gravity-fed water systems from end to end. There's a few exceptions, but the vast majority require electrically pumped water. And the big towers that you see over most cities, big water towers, only provide a 2 or 3 day supply. And once those are gone, once those are drained, people will be out of luck. And in areas like the Southwest, you're immediately going to see huge numbers of refugees on the road because they're simply going to be out of water.
Right. Do you see any kind of martial law taking effect in a grid collapse situation, or do you think it's even feasible on a broad scale?
There's definitely the possibility of martial law, but I think it's going to be more of an attempt at martial law in a grid down collapse, because I think that events will cascade to the point where the chaos that ensues if the grid goes down is going to develop so rapidly, it's just going to be galloping along to the point where any attempt at martial law is going to be fruitless. They won't be able to erect roadblocks that are meaningful. They'll be bypassed or overwhelmed if they attempt to bottle up urban populations. There are some situations where martial law would be feasible in a grid-up situation, but in a grid-down situation, I think that the authorities would simply lose control very quickly.
Mm-hmm. And I failed to mention at the opening of the interview that you're also a former Army intelligence officer, and I've spoken to my work puts me in touch with other folks who have your background in Army intelligence or military intelligence, and when the conversation gets to martial law, just about everybody says that, you know, even now except for on a localized scale or a regional scale, that we just don't have the manpower to enforce martial law.
Even
when you consider calling in UN troops and other, you know, such the theories that are bouncing around out there. But one concern that I have, and this kind of leads into a location for a survival retreat, but I've been covering this subject on my show over the last several weeks. I recently relocated to a rural area myself, and one of the topics that I keep revisiting is where the best places are. And I know some people who are thinking about moving to Texas, and I think a border state move is a horrible idea, because there's no way that we're going to be able to enforce a border on a grid down situation, and with all the crime and drug trade and everything like that coming in from Mexico, it's just going to be a chaos. It's going to be a horrible situation.
Well, I agree there, at least for the southern border. I think the Canadian border would probably be pretty stable. If anything, it'll be probably the Canadians trying to keep Americans out.
Yeah.
or should I say oot, keep the Americans out. There's definitely a preferred range of locales that I've laid forth in some of my writings, in my blog, and in my books.
Mm-hmm.
I tend toward the inland northwest region, basically eastern Oregon, eastern Washington, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming. And it's an area that I refer to as the American Redoubt.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably, all in all, going to be one of the safest areas to be, simply because the population density is quite low compared to the rest of the United States. If you look at a satellite map of the United States, especially the ones taken at night, and you see the lights of the United States, you can immediately see the population density is much, much higher in the eastern half of the country, or eastern two-thirds even.
Right.
But once you get out west, the population density drops off dramatically, and the only exceptions primarily are on the Pacific coast. In between, you have the basin and range country of the American West, and the northern portion of that, which includes the Rockies and northern Rockies and the basin and range country, I think is ideal because you have a low population density, a lot of people involved in agriculture, extensive woodland areas where you have all the firewood in the world, and you have geographic isolation from the major population centers.
Right.
From where I'm sitting right now, it's hundreds of miles to the nearest big city, at least of any appreciable size. I don't think that in the event of a major societal collapse, we're going to see many problems here compared to anyone on the coast or anyone in the heavily populated eastern United States. Our chances, I'm not saying it's an absolute, but our chances of survival here, I think, are much, much better simply because the population density is less. Fewer people mean fewer problems.
Absolutely. Yeah, in fact, your writing on the readout states heavily informed my decision-making process. I had considered Idaho as I had narrowed it down to Idaho and New Hampshire. And unfortunately, I decided due to, you know, family, I have family, and I have three nephews and a niece whom, you know, I'm really concerned about, and I really don't want to be too far away from them when things go sideways. But Idaho was absolutely my first choice, was neck and neck with New Hampshire, for all of the reasons that you mentioned, lower density population and lots of resources. Now, one of the things that I've been concerned about lately, and I don't know if you've been following this, but back in June, Obama signed an executive order, which was called the Rural Council, and it's basically a implementation of Agenda 21 principles in which I'm telling people, and you people like you and I are telling people to relocate to a rural area, and this program, this Agenda 21, their goal is to block people from accessing rural areas and resources and making people, you know, establishing urban habitation zones, as they're called. Have you been following any of that, or have you been seeing this in your area?
That planning has gone on for 30-plus years, and it fits into the whole biodiversity corridor system that's been proposed. And the whole mindset behind it is social engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And it is quite frightening. Now, how much of that has been implemented or will be implemented is anyone's guess. But we have to look at it as just something to file under the Emerging Threats Department and make our plans accordingly.
Right. Do you see any NGOs, non-governmental organizations under the guise of sustainable development programs in your area?
No, and I don't think that it's very likely that they'll actually engage NGOs. You know, I'm more worried about the corporatization of police, for example. I think that is one definite possibility. They're already corporatizing prisons. I think they might try to corporatize police forces in the future. And in terms of individual interaction with authorities, I think that would probably be a significant threat, because there you're essentially dealing with, you know, corporate law rather than constitutional law.
Yeah, right, absolutely.
I think that in terms of NGOs, probably not. Other than that, and there might be some things done under the guise of environmentalism, wildlife management, and so on that will have an impact on people. For example, if they do the biodiversity plan and implement wildlife corridors, they could try to put travel restrictions on people, lock off huge areas of national forest lands, for example, and state forest lands. That could have an impact on people. You know, you'd be reduced to cutting firewood in your own backyard and hunting in your own backyard if you can't get access to public lands. So there's definitely a risk there.
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, I think the greatest risk that we will face, it doesn't come from the government. It comes from our neighbors. You know, I'm a big proponent of charity, but I'm also a big proponent of keeping a low profile.
Mm-hmm.
We may see a time in the near future when you don't want to have any outward displays of wealth. You don't want to be driving a fancy vehicle that's just a year or two old. You don't want to be wearing a Rolex watch and nice clothes, regardless of where you live, whether it's the big city or out in the boonies. I highly recommend that people blend in and dress down.
Right. Now, you're a big proponent, as am I, of connecting with your immediate community and community preparedness. And one of the things that I want to ask, it's always kind of a sketchy situation, is, you know, people are reticent to approach their neighbors with, you know, what they're doing for fear of either at least being called a kook or being thought of as one, and at worst having, you know, a mob of people at your door when things do go sideways and they're all wanting to take what you got. How do you approach it, and how do you get involved in your community as far as organizing or you know, getting people aware of the need to prepare? Or do you have to?
Well, where I live, which is way out in the hinterboonies, everybody's pretty well prepared and self-sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
So the talk about preparedness is, pretty commonplace. People around here only go shopping about once a month in the big city, or what we consider a big city. You go into a town of 50,000. But... So it's really not a major OPSEC issue, although I'm still very quiet about discussing the level of my preparations, and I recommend that people do the same. That there's no need to tell people exactly, you know, what you have squared away. It's just a matter of encouraging them, encouraging your neighbors, your friends, you know, fellow church congregants, to get prepared. Say, you know, I've laid in some food for my family. I recommend you do the same, and here's why.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, every family that gets squared away represents one less family that's going to be begging on your doorstep when everything hits the fan. So it's in your best interest to make sure your neighbors get well squared away. And, of course, charity is important. It's important to store extra for charity. I don't look at my 3-year food supply that I've laid in for my family as a 3-year supply for one family. I look at it as a 3-year supply, a 3-year supply for one family. I look at it as a 1-year supply for three families.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to think in terms of charity, but also to plan ahead to dispense that charity at arm's length. I plan to do so through my local church very quietly, where I will be handing off quantities of storage food to the church elders, and they will distribute it to people without my name ever being mentioned. That way, when the food runs out, people won't come looking to me for more. I want to maintain a low profile, but I also want to be charitable.
Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to there are several throughout the country, there are several survival groups or planned survival communities, and some of them are not in the most ideal locations. I'm not sure what they were thinking of when they decided to, you know, base it in western New Mexico or somewhere where there's not a lot of water availability. I lived a better part of a decade in Arizona. I love the Southwest, but I don't think I can go back there just for that reason. But when it comes to putting together a deliberate survival group, what is the ideal number of people that will serve enough manpower for protection, for security, as well as for self-sustainability?
I would say in the range of 3 to 6 families. Anything larger, you're probably going to run into OPSEC issues, and anything less, you're not going to have the manpower to maintain round-the-clock security. You know, in addition to round-the-clock, you know, you need 24/7 security. You also need 360-degree security. That's quite a bit of manpower. And by the time you staff all that, you, if you only have a couple of families, you don't have the manpower available for summertime, which is your peak manpower need time for when you're going to be both cutting firewood and gardening. You can either feed everyone and have incomplete security, or have full security and quietly starve. It's not a very enviable decision to make. So I do recommend having at least three families.
Preparing yourself for an emergency doesn't have to be all about doom and gloom. Getting all worked up about an impending disaster isn't going to better prepare you. It's just going to stress you out. Here at survival-gear.com, we believe your main goal when putting together a survival kit is to not just have the critical items you need in order to stay alive, but the right supplies in sufficient quantity to shield you from the effects of an extended unfortunate event. I like to say that if you have to use your survival kit, it should seem more like an impromptu camping trip rather than a dire emergency. Likewise, if a hurricane, earthquake, or tornado make your home unusable, you want to be able to set up camp and still be relatively comfortable. Even during a survival scenario, staying warm, dry, hydrated, and fed doesn't have to seem like roughing it. At survival-gear.com, our goal is to better prepare you by providing full-fledged survival kits that you can absolutely count on. Visit survival-gear.com and check out our premium line of survival kits. Silver has been in use as an effective antimicrobial for thousands of years, and this old technology is still in use today. In 2001, a patent was approved for a new medical silver application, nanocatalytic silver hydrosols. Unlike conventional colloidal silver products, some of the advantages of nanosilver include up to 300% greater bioavailability, proven non-toxicity in over 25 university and FDA-approved laboratory studies, and extreme stability with a shelf life of over 10 years. Guarantee. With just one product, you can replace all the antibiotics, wound and burn dressings, and water purification products in your medical bug-out bag. These products have been patented for use against some of the deadliest pathogens known, many that are resistant to traditional antibiotics, yet are safe and gentle enough for treating a baby's diaper rash. To learn more about this medical silver breakthrough and see the published scientific studies, visit www.lifesilver.com. All orders ship within 24 hours with deep discounts and free shipping for case orders. That's www.lifesilver.com.
Now, you hear a lot of talk when it comes to grid crash and long-term grid crash, where basically we're just starting back from square one. We're down to 19th century methods and techniques. But I've lived for extended periods of time without electricity. It's not a big deal to me, but there are still some things, you know, that that require electricity that'll be nice to have. And a lot of people have misconceptions about alternative forms of energy like solar power. They think, oh, just slap a couple solar panels on the roof and you'll be all set. And that's really unrealistic in both terms of cost and terms of viability. But you have a lot of great ideas about small-scale solar and alternative sources of energy, and as well as other types of like lighting arrangements and things like that. I was wondering if you might talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, we've discussed those at length in my blog. Again, it's survivalblog.com. We've got thousands of articles and letters that have been archived. A lot of those have to do with alternative energy. A lot of how people go about setting up a home power system is really dependent on where they live. For someone in the Southwest, photovoltaics may be a good option. For someone who is on some high mountain ridge somewhere, wind power may make most sense. For someone who lives in canyon lands and has a big year-round creek running through their property with quite a bit of fall in it, then microhydro probably makes the most sense. But regardless of the initial power source you have, there are some constants. You have to think in terms of the total loads, electrical loads that you're going to have to run in your house. People have to get used to a much more modest lifestyle. you're not going to have big capacitive loads. You're not going to have things like an electric stove or an electric hot water heater with an alternative energy system. It's just not realistic. And unless you are blessed with living on a piece of property that has its own natural gas well, so you can run a generator, you know, great big 10 or 12 kilowatt generator 24 hours a day, for anyone else, if you're working on an alternative power system, whether it's wind or photovoltaic or micro hydro, you have to have very modest expectations and scale everything back. And, of course, you also have to think, if it's a long-term scenario, a grid-down scenario, you also have to look at the useful lifetime of battery banks. A typical lead-acid battery needs to be replaced every 8 or 9 years. There's a few tricks you can do to help minimize the sulfating of batteries, but you still, you know, 10 years probably is the maximum life you're going to get out of a lead-acid battery with the sulfating that goes on. So if you set up a solar power, like a photovoltaic power system, and you do go into a long-term scenario, you may start out with a system with a nice battery bank, but 10 years down the road, you're going to end up with a daytime-only system with no overnight battery capacity. You have to think through each of those issues and make plans accordingly. Come up with, you know, I'm a big believer in always having a plan B and a plan C. So you have to think through what you will do when things happen, like your battery bank becomes useless in a really long-term situation. I even look at things in multi-generational terms. You know, what are you going to do? What are your great-grandchildren going to do when the fertilizer you've stored is no longer viable, or where the ammunition you've stored is no longer viable? Here we're talking 100 years out. If you look at things on a multi-generational scale, the challenges become pretty overwhelming.
Right, and that's the crux of the biscuit right there, is that any kind of alternative energy system that you set up is ultimately going to come down to the batteries, and nothing lasts forever. I try to take a little bit. Well, in one hand, I'm of two minds about it. On one hand, you know, it's best to just get used to living wouldn't call it primitive, but, you know, non-technological lifestyle, and just, you know, completely do away with any kind of electrical device. Or, you know, it's still not a bad idea. I think if you have those systems, no, it won't last forever, but still it'll probably help you get over the hump. You know, until you do get on your feet. You know, I get a lot of emails from readers of my magazine, Survivalist Magazine, and, you know, anytime you mention anything that has to do with an electrical power device, like, oh, what are you going to do when the grid goes down? What are you going to do when your battery's run? It's like, well, you know, it doesn't mean that you should throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's still a good idea to have these systems just to make things, you know, so they're not like real drastic, real severe right away. You know, you can kind of ease out of it, out of the situation. But when it comes to generators, what types of generators do you recommend as far as like a fuel source?
Well, primarily propane-fired generators, because you don't have the safety issues and the short storage life issues of gasoline. And with propane generators or diesel generators, depending on where you live, for people who live in Canada or in the very, you know, say you're in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, for example, where you have really cold winters, I don't recommend diesel at all. But in most of the country, diesel is a very good option. Mm-hmm. It stores quite well. You're talking 8 to 12 years probably. But propane, though, can be stored indefinitely. And for flexibility, I recommend tri-fuel generators, where you can have a carburetor kit so you can burn propane or gasoline or natural gas, piped natural gas, very easily. They are fairly high RPM compared to diesel generators. You don't have quite the same longevity, But in terms of the fuel flexibility, I think that is definitely the way to go. But and again, unless you live on a property where you have your own natural gas well, you've got to look at that. Unless you're a millionaire and you can afford some huge, you know, tank farm of propane tanks, it's a short-term potential there. Long-term, I lean more toward photovoltaics, and I believe that systems should be sized based on people's budgets rather than going deep in debt. And at the very minimum, people should have a modest photovoltaic power system with, say, 30 watts of panels, a couple of 15-watt panels, so that you can at least do some battery charging so you can keep a cell phone charged, so you can charge a few batteries and run a couple of small lights. Those batteries are crucial for your home security because you want to be able to run a passive intrusion detection system like a Dakota Alert, and you want to be able to run night vision optics. You'll need batteries for those to be able to charge your nickel metal hydride batteries, your NIM batteries. So it's important to at least have a small system, and because with that, you are going to greatly improve your chances of maintaining security, and you can make a very small security force operate as if it has the combat power of a much larger force. If you have the advantage in night vision, for example, and intrusion detection, you can be much more effective with a small force.
Mm-hmm. Now, you recommend the nickel metal hydride, I'm asking, why not lithium ion?
Lithium ion are definitely an option. The technology isn't quite as mature. The cost per watt is fairly high for lithium ion. They do have the same number of cycles as nickel metal hydride. They also have the advantage of no memory effect like nickel hydride, which, of course, both of those get past the bugaboo of the traditional nickel-cadmium batteries, which is the memory effect, where they won't hold a full charge at some point down the road. Lithium-ion is definitely a possibility, but I generally, because of the maturity of the technology and the cost per amp hour, I definitely lean toward, for small batteries, lean toward nickel metal hydride.
Mm-hmm. And I should mention to our listeners, tonight we also have John Melandrid on the line. He's the founder of the Prepper Podcast Radio Network, as well as my producer. John, I want to give you a chance. I don't want to hog up the whole time. Do you want to ask Jim any questions?
You know, I had some questions, and every time I'm thinking about it, he's already answering them. So he's already ahead of me. One thing, have you ever did any experimentation with heating your water in your house with compost?
No, and that's one technology that I haven't really gone into detail in my blog. The other one I'd like to address that deals with manure or compost is producer gas, which is also known as gobar gas. That's what they call it in the Middle East, where you can basically create home methane. You're essentially capping a cesspool for primarily agricultural, coming out of cattle or swine or sheep, and capping that and piping off methane gas. I think both of those are fascinating technologies. The problem with space heating with that bio waste is getting past the smell issue. I guess if you want to live 19th century style and can deal with what the Germans call Landluft, which is the smell of the land, it's probably a good one. But otherwise, you have a thermal barrier. You need to conduct heat from one side to the other and then be able to push heat with forced air past that barrier if you want to have an odor barrier. Without the odor barrier, it can be a pretty pungent situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I've been doing pretty much small-scale testing, but where I take and I actually do my composting system, and I have the pipe on the inner circles, so it's actually three layers of pipe and three different mm-hmm. layers. And I've been generating my hot water through that, so I don't have to boil it, because that's a pain. I live just like the pioneers. So
does this provide like preheat levels, like 140, 150 degrees?
Yes, so that I can wash the dishes, and okay. It's warm enough. And then what I did is took an old radiator, basically, and modified it to where the water is just pumped through the radiator and then back okay. in, so it's on a continuous loop. And it just okay. gives you radiant heat in your house.
Someone that lived in the plains states where you didn't have firewood available, where you could run a water jacket for heating water, that probably would be quite viable and economical. Anytime you develop a complex piping system, though, you've got to worry about, you know, leaks in the long term.
Yeah.
yeah. And spare parts and all that sort of thing. And of course, the thermal control, if it's a boiler system, you've got to have some pretty heavy-duty safety features. If it's a low heat, like produced by, you know, biological sources, that really isn't a big issue. For water heating, I think it's quite viable. For space heating, again, you've got that thermal barrier issue. But yes, they're all fascinating technologies. I would really like to get into experimenting with producer gas, the GoBar gas.
Yeah.
Because not everyone is going to live in, you know, eastern Wyoming and have a natural gas well in their backyard or in the Four Corners area of New Mexico. That's where my new novel is set, in fact, is in natural mm-hmm. gas country around Farmington, New Mexico, is the main locale of my new novel that's coming out in October.
And your first novel, Patriots, was on the New York Times bestsellers list, if I'm not mistaken. And a lot of people were surprised about that. It kind of came out of the blue as far as, like, you know, showing up in the mainstream. Do you find that more and more people are waking up and they're getting
Oh, definitely. Yeah,
aware?
There's definitely a stronger interest in preparedness because a broader and broader segment of society is recognizing the fragility of our society. And it's just rational self-interest that people want to get prepared. They see how fragile our society is. They see what a horrible job government agencies do of providing aid in the event of a disaster. I often refer to FEMA as standing for foolishly expecting meaningful aid. I think people are definitely waking up. There's definitely more of an interest in preparedness, and it's coming from all angles. I mean, from the quasi-comedic side, from people who joke about zombie apocalypse, to people strictly looking at for, you know, self-sufficiency for gardening, the soccer mom crowd, to all the way to more serious preppers and survivalists that are looking at a disaster where there'll be a period without rule of law. It pretty well runs the gamut, but what is surprising is that the segments of society that are interested keep growing and growing. And if you look at popular culture, if you look at the movies that are being produced these days, you know, everything from, you know, the Book of Eli on, there's definitely a strong interest in preparedness, and I can't blame folks. I think they're quite rational for being interested in learning self-sufficiency and preparedness and self-defense and everything else that goes along with it.
Yeah, I've started to notice the same trend myself. Over the years, it's gone from me having to beat people over the head with preparedness and survival and to where it doesn't really, you know, it's not really an unknown subject that much anymore when I approach it with strangers or just, you know, people that I meet on a regular basis. It seems that a lot more people are at least somewhat on board with it because, people can see what's going on with the economy. People can see what's going on with the government. There's, you know, you don't even have to stray into conspiracy theory or talk about 2012 or, you know, anything like that.
Mainstream.
Right.
The mainstream now. Yes, and the people that you know, 10 or 15 years ago that were teasing us about being prepared are all getting prepared themselves now. So people are definitely coming around, and there's definitely a stronger interest. It's just a matter of making sure that people look at this in the long term. It shouldn't just be a flash in the pan. It shouldn't be like Y2K, where everybody went out and bought an AR-15 and a generator and thought they were ready for Y2K. And then as soon as Y2K turned into a non-event, all those generators and AR-15s ended up on the secondary market.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping that people that are preparing now, including the ones that are fixated on the Mayan calendar in 2012, I'm hoping that they're preparing for the long haul and that they will stick with their preparedness rather than having it just be a short-term little fad. I don't think it's a fad this time.
I think Y2K did a disservice in that, you know, it's most people's reactions when you talk about prepping now. They're like, oh, yeah, I like Y2K, and look what happened there, nothing. So, you know, I think for a while it became hard to convince people that, you know, don't even think about Y2K. There's a lot of other things that are coming down the road that you know, that we need to be prepared for. And, like, even with just a solar flare, you know, we're entering into a solar maximum, and there's dispute among scientists as to whether it's going to be any kind of, you know, catastrophic thing, but, you know, it could happen, and you should be prepared for that. And this brings me to my other subject that I wanted you to talk about, as far as, like, protecting your vehicles and whatnot. And I know you recommend older vehicles that do not have any fuel injection or kind of electronics. Is there anything in particular that you could suggest as far as like a make
or
model?
Well, in terms of both EMP and the natural equivalent, which would be coronal mass ejection, you know, solar flare events, their effects are very similar, and the shielding that you need and the precautions that you need to take are very similar. For vehicles, I recommend that you buy a pre-1972 gas engine vehicle out of Detroit and restore it, or you can get away with this up to the middle 1980s by retrofitting a vehicle with a electronic ignition system. You can retrofit it back to a traditional points, plugs, and condenser arrangement, a traditional rotor ignition system. For diesels, my favorites would be either like a pre-1994 Ford or Chevy diesel that does not have fuel injection or other electronic controls. The only electronic components you have would possibly be some circuitry that leads to the glow plug. But otherwise, they're pretty darn EMP-proof. You might want to stock a few spare parts and check out the wiring diagrams and make sure there aren't a lot of fancy electronics between your ignition switch and the glow plug.
Mm-hmm.
But diesels are pretty straightforward. For passenger cars, I like the pre-1985 diesel Mercedes. The perfect vehicle there would be a 1984 or earlier W123 chassis Mercedes wagon, like a 300D or 300TD diesel wagon. Again, all you've got is a glow plug and a relay. You could have incredibly high EMP field strength, and that vehicle is still going to start and run.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've
your home go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
I was just going to say, in terms of home electronics, the crucial thing is to have redundancy and to remember to keep your antennas disconnected for your primary electronics and keep all of your spare electronics in Faraday enclosures. And the least expensive per square foot is just a standard galvanized gas trash can that you can get at any hardware store. A typical 25 or 30 gallon trash can with a tight fitting metal lid makes a perfect Faraday enclosure. Just going to put all your spare electronics, you wrap them in plastic, put a couple of trash bags around each component and stack them up in. You can fit a tremendous number of spare radios, your spare laptop, any other electronics should be stored in a Faraday enclosure like that, and you'll be safe from all but the most, you know, if the field strength is strong enough to fry something in that enclosure, then you're going to be at ground zero of an explosion, and EMP will be the least of your concerns. You'll be pounded with so much hard gamma, you'll have maybe a 24-hour life expectancy.
Yeah.
So you'll be right in the blast radius. But for anyone outside of the blast radius, the field strength will be such that anything that's in a Faraday enclosure like that, that's not connected to a power source and not connected to an antenna, that's completely isolated, will be fine. So it's important to have redundancy with your all of your electronics and keep all your spares in cans.
Mm-hmm. I've read that even a cardboard box with wrapped in aluminum foil and then double boxed, you know, double aluminum foil.
Yeah, if you don't have a large metal container. But what I recommend people do is just keep their eyes peeled. You know, every Christmas people in the United States for the last 20 years have been very fond of giving large containers of popcorn in steel cans with tight-fitting lids. Mm-hmm. Those work fine as a Faraday enclosure. As I mentioned, a standard garbage can with a tight-fitting lid works fine. A military ammo can will also work well, although they do have a rubber gasket. You just got to make sure that you have a good electrical connection between the lid and the body of the can. And with a standard American design, typically you have four or five pins for the hinge that provide a good connection between the two. So a military ammo can will work fine, and some of those are built quite large, like the standard U.S. military 20-millimeter ammo can is, 20 inches long and 16 or 18 inches tall and 9 inches wide. It's quite a bit of volume there that's available, and they also have the advantage of being watertight, so you can even bury them if need be. They're a little bit more multi-purpose than a galvanized can.
Right. Well, unfortunately, we're reaching the end of our time here with Mr. Rawls, and it's been great having you on the show, and I'd love to have you back on the show as a guest again, but I appreciate
you
taking the time.
And thank you, John, too.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I really enjoyed being on. I'd love to be back on, and I do encourage people to take a look at the archives of my blog. They're all available free of charge. You can search through thousands and thousands of posts. It's all available free and fully searchable. Again, it's at survivalblog.com.
Okay, and that'll do it for this installment of Survival and Beyond, and I hope you've enjoyed this encore presentation of my interview with James Wesley Rawls. And next week we'll be back with all new guests and all the information and news from the worlds of survival and preparedness, as well as the news that you won't get from the mainstream media, the disinformation machine, as it were, that affects our liberty and our freedom, all here on Survival and Beyond every week, as usual, on the Natural News Radio Network, as well as the Prepper Podcast Radio Network. And don't forget to check us out at survivalandbeyond.net. You can download a ton of free survival guides and ebooks. We've got videos. We've got all kinds of news and information. So check us out on survivalandbeyond.net. And hey, while you're at it, don't forget about that new the Social Network for Patriots Awareness Act at awarenessact.com. And you can friend me. Just look me up, Ed Corcoran, there on Awareness Act. And also there's a Survival and Beyond page there as well, where you can feel free to say what's on your mind without the fear of being surveilled upon or data mined by government agencies. It's a completely secure network that they own their own servers, and they're offshore. for, rock solid security. So it's a great place for patriots to go and talk about what's going down, and you know, waking people up and waking each other up and spreading news and information, because that's the only way it's going to happen. That's the only way it's going to happen. The mass communication that we need in the patriot movement, in the liberty movement, is to have a place like this where we can disseminate information freely without fear of censorship, first of all, that you'll get from some of the other social networks, or you know what I'm talking about, and also without the fear of being spied upon and having the feds show up at your house to haul you away to a mental institution or worse. Don't forget, Barry's still fighting for indefinite detention, fighting for those powers that he promised that he would never ever use, yet he insisted that they be in there, and now he's keeps getting extensions and appeals and whatnot. So Awareness Act is a great place to, we got a lot of exciting things going on. And I've been very active on the social network as well, and making suggestions and working with Marshall and Mike and the guys there. So check it out. We need all the patriots we can get. And until next week, keep your head up. Keep on living free. Don't take any crap from anybody. We'll catch you next week.